back to Build, Lead, Thrive, Voices of Andras Skagen, a bi-monthly podcast that features in-depth conversations with the people shaping Andras Skagen County. Each episode dives into personal stories, showcasing the leaders and entrepreneurs behind the region's economic and community vitality. I'm your host, Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the LA Metro Chamber. I'm joined by local talent, longtime friend, and thank goodness, our producer, Mark Turcotte. Hello, sir.
How are you?
I'm good. Grateful for your editing skills.
Oh, come on.
Together, we explore how incredible people, the voices of Andras Skagen, build, lead, and thrive while contributing to a better quality of life for all. Today's guest is someone who's been shaping Maine's food systems and community spaces for more than 25 years. I'm sure she shakes to realize that's the number. She's done it all with her hands in the dirt and her heart in the work. Kirsten Walter first came to Lewiston in 1996 through Bates College and never really left, thank goodness. She spent the decades since building a life, career, and community here in the LA region. She's the founding director of the St. Mary's Nutrition Center and launched its flagship program, Lots to Gardens, back in 1999, planting both literal and figurative seeds for change. Kirsten brings deep experience in designing collaborative, long-term partnerships that build connection, create opportunity, and advance justice through food. Whether she's convening stakeholders around a shared table or helping youth grow their own food and confidence, she's built a reputation, one I can personally attest to, and a career around trust, impact, and nourishment in every sense of the word. She's also been a catalyst behind some of the most influential food and public health initiatives in Maine, including the Good Food Council of Lewiston Auburn, Healthy Neighborhoods, the Maine Network of Community Food Councils, and the Maine Food Strategy. We're so excited to have her on the podcast today, so let's dig in. Do you see what I did there? I can't help myself. So let's start at the very beginning. Yeah. With a name like Shanna, that I get called Shannon, Shana, Shauna, Sharon, which I don't know where you're pulling the R from. Say your own name.
Yeah, Kirsten.
See, how do you tell people how to get your name right? Because I'm stuck with my dad calls me Shanna Banana.
Yes, that's a good one. It's actually from my dad, too. So I get Kirsten, Kristen, Christina. I don't know where the A comes from for that one.
Thank you, right?
Christian.
Just making up extra words, guys.
Exactly. And so my dad would say, Dear Keir.
Aww.
With Keir. So my people who are close in my family call me Keir, but the dear Kirsten helps people get it.
See, shout out to the dads who both named us in a way that's challenging and then give us a rhyme to make it easier for the rest of our lives.
Yes, exactly.
So all of that is true.
Yeah, when you
it's
put
crazy
it there.
When someone else says it, isn't it?
I'm like, well, I should use this for my
she
bio.
She sent me a little short bio, you guys, and I colored outside the lines a little bit based on some personal experience and publicly available data.
Yeah.
But you've had an incredible life.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm not from Maine, but I know because
okay.
I'm from away, but I tell everybody, I like the moment I had a choice, I chose here. I'm so glad that I did. I mean, this, as much as you in kind of introducing me said, like, here's what Kirsten is doing. Like, I think for me, I reflect on how much this community has shaped me. Mm-hmm. You know, I was 18 when I moved here. And
I can't picture that. A little 18-year-old Kirsten bopping around town. Dirty hands and overalls. That's how I would picture it.
Definitely overalls.
I mean, you were an 18-year-old Bates student.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But even, And I definitely remember some, long before I was doing the gardens, just, getting so excited to get to know Lewiston. I actually showed up here for an interview in the middle of January at the old bus station on Main Street. And had an interaction that day that, both let me understand some of the challenges that this community has faced, but also, the beauty. I got to walk through all of downtown helping an older woman get some help. And people are like,
you didn't have to. I would just point that out. You didn't have to. You chose to.
Oh, no. I definitely chose to. I wasn't going to leave her there as the bus station closed. That was a formative experience just for my introduction to this community. From that day forward, I was like, I want to be here.
See, I also had the good fortune to choose this community, and in so many ways, I feel like it chose me back. So, all right, before we get into all of the good stuff, and this is a little bit of a local controversy, we're just gonna wade into the water a little bit with a little segment we like to call "Getting to Know You."
I've heard you sing.
Oh no!
See. reputation precedes us, Mark. The question is, do we or don't we? Do you know the song?
I don't want to admit that I do.
Would you sing it? Because that could sway the vote.
It can make it worse, I'm sure.
I don't know about that. You've heard us.
I'm not convinced that's not the goal, or at least what we want
like
people to believe.
Julie Andrews, like, you've got to, like, actually, like, get into it.
Please do.
No, bleed the way.
No, please don't. I mean,
anything you do will be a welcome addition.
An improvement for sure over our past example.
Well, my kiddo can actually sing, like, perfectly on key, and my husband and I are like, where did that come from?
Because it's not from you guys.
No,
skipped a generation genetic trait.
Exactly.
How about we just talk about
that? We'll talk about it.
Yeah,
thank you for saving me that.
Yeah, it was a total gift for you and you alone.
Our first segment is called Getting to Know You, where we ask guests fun, personality-revealing questions to help you learn about and connect with our guests on a personal level. Before we get into the deeper questions, this is like the appetizer before the main course.
Okay, one question. What's one food that instantly brings you back to childhood? Because I know food is relationships, food is community, food is memories. That's something you and I kind of share in our values. So, like, what's a food that, like, all of a sudden you're back in your favorite childhood memory?
There's many, but I would say strawberries.
Oh.
And because my mom had a garden, no surprise there.
Nope, none.
And I loved to help in the garden, and we also had a big strawberry patch as part of that. And I grew up in California where it's much drier, so you have to water the garden. It doesn't rain all summer, you water the garden. And so I would get up early, and I would go out, and I would pick strawberries, and I'd eat them, and I'd pick peas, and I'd eat them, and I would, like, you know, help and water, and then spray myself because it was hot. And then I'd come in, and my mom would be like, what do you want for breakfast? And I'm like, I'm all set. Because I've, like, been grazing.
Did she know? Like, were you out there helping independently, and she didn't see you eat all of the snacks?
I mean, she knew I was grazing, I'm sure.
I bet your face showed it.
Yeah,
I can't eat strawberries without it being, like, all over.
But yeah, but a fresh strawberry that's, like, warm from the morning sun, there's really nothing like that. And
did you have to plant them each year? Or did you have the, like, because we have little tiny, I don't know, native,
wild strawberries. Yeah,
they come back every year, which I love, and I'm not good enough about planting them early enough.
Yeah, so strawberries, you plant, they're a perennial where it actually has a mother, and it sends out little little seedlings. So it'll send out a runner, and then that'll be your next one. So it'll basically, as long as you care for it, you can have a bed that reseeds. Commercially, they do it a little bit differently, but for a home bed.
Is that true in Maine now?
Yeah.
Like, could you give me a mother? Could I do that?
Yeah, you can do it. And there's ones that
not can I. Can you?
Yeah.
Can you help me do that?
You know who can help?
I appreciate personal responsibility, but I've tried and failed many times.
The really talented members of our garden team can help.
Okay, great.
That.
That's, I love delegation.
Also, because most people are like, oh, you know a lot about gardening. You must have a beautiful garden. And I'm like, absolutely not. I have a garden that's very functional. But
you're like the roofer whose house leaks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think that's true for so many of us.
Yeah.
What is something that people might be surprised to learn about you? A hobby, a skill, a fun fact? Give our listeners something new, never seen outside your private social circle.
Huh.
And radio appropriate.
Yes, of course. I'm pretty G-rated. So
yes, I know. That's why I thought it was funny to say it. But I'm realizing other people, by the end of this episode, you guys will understand why that was funny. Yeah. You'll just have to replay it to laugh.
Yeah. Well, I would say one thing that people, when I say it, they say makes sense but don't know originally, is that I'm an absolute introvert. And my role requires me to really be people-facing, and I actually love people, so that motivates me to engage. But I am not actually comfortable in any any big group setting. I can fake it, kind of.
I can attest that you fake it well.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, but I can appreciate that.
It's not like my sweet spot where I'm happy and in the spotlight. And that anyone, you know, who went to a wedding of mine would know that was the case.
You were the person in the front being like, okay, that's enough.
Yeah.
That is enough.
Yeah.
Let's call it. Everybody
enough
take
attention.
Your food to go.
Yeah. And say, that's one thing that's not like a hobby or anything, but just a part of me.
Yeah. I mean, for all the places I've seen you in public settings, I'm sure if that's the only venue people knew you in, they would be surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes a ton of sense.
I will add one thing. It's not like a fun fact or skill, but people hear my hobbies and think that I am like a thrill seeker, but I love to mountain bike, I love to rock climb, and I love to telemark ski.
I'm sorry, what kind of ski?
Telemark ski.
Go on.
So it is where you don't have your heels down. So it's like what people used to do to ski. Like if you think about cross country skis, yeah. but put edges on them so you can go downhill.
Terrifying.
But you have to bend your knees to be able to move your weight. So it's a very different kind of motion. But what I love to do is go uphill. So you go uphill with these very special little tools on the bottom. And so you hike up a mountain and then you ski down it. That is like my, like I'm so happy. That is my happy place. But I'm not an expert at any of it. I'm like just moderate at all of it. So people are like, oh, you're like a thrill seeker. I'm like, no, I actually just really like to be outside.
You don't have to be an expert to be a thrill seeker.
No, but actually,
I can attest to that, yes, first of all. But I feel like the maybe a little just a little bit thrill seeking.
No, I love being outside and moving outside. So
yeah.
So I'm not a good at lying on the beach. I'd love to be, but I love to just move outside. So.
Yeah.
But most people like picture that and they're like, you're climbing up huge mountains. And I'm like, no, I'm going up Rumford Whitecap.
It counts.
And then skiing down the snowmobile trail, you know, so.
No, we'll count that.
Yeah.
We'll count that. This one, I feel like I can guess the answer. I'm excited to see if I'm surprised. What's a place in Lewiston, Auburn that always makes you feel rooted or inspired?
Oh.
It's a little bit of a leading question,
yes,
but you don't have to take the bait.
I know. I mean, well, the amount of hours I spend in one place, the Nutrition Center on Bates Street, is definitely where our roots are. I started this work, our very first gardens were out at Hillview, and there's something about that community that I love.
Yeah.
And I have so many, I think when you do something for as like, especially like no career changes, just growth within the same community and same area of work.
You know, that's super rare these days in general,
like
25 years. And I mean, you didn't just stay with, you built the organization.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without leaving.
Right. And
not going anywhere.
No. And it was always one step ahead of me. So it's always been like, a major challenge the whole time trying to keep up with what we're trying to do, and trying to create. But I think the very first couple of years were pushing me so far outside of my skill sets and comfort zone in a very visceral way. And so my memories from those first couple of years, other years can kind of blend together a little bit, but I have just such vivid connections and memories to that community and the people who were there when we built the first gardens.
And you still have gardens there.
Oh yeah, we do. Yeah, there's kids out there gardening as well as families.
Shall we get to the main course? There's a lot of ground to cover, and we could go in a million different directions. So a little insight that is outside of Kirsten's bio. We've been in relationship in community-based work I feel like you're part of my core and first memories of being in this community. And so, you know, 15, 18 years we've been working together. And so I have this challenge today. It's an advantage that I know so many facets of you, your work. I've been able to see the work that you do grow, the organization grow. I've been able to watch incredible people who work for you and with you grow into incredible leaders within the work and within the community. And so the challenge for me today is to figure out the right handful of questions that'll be able to surface all of that goodness, which we'll never get to. All right, so let's maybe start kind of at the beginning.
Yeah.
You've been a steady and visionary leader in food systems work, and so few people, at least until your work and locally, but so few people are able to think about food and systems.
Yeah.
But you've been leading food systems work for over two decades, founding Lots to Gardens, growing the Nutrition Center, and co-creating collaborative structures statewide that helps get at systems, change systems, think about systems. I think part of what I've always loved about your work and what I've challenged myself to describe to others when they're like, oh, they do the gardens. And I'm like, well, yes. I've literally watched you create a food movement in less than two decades. And, you know, for those of us who have done community change or community organizing work, it's really different to start a program or to, you know, do an event or do a campaign. I'm proud of the times I've been part of that work, and there are incredible people doing incredible things with that work. But that's
always
not building a movement.
Yeah.
A movement is just something that, like, at some point grows beyond you and gets its own momentum. And what originally drew you to this kind of work, and how has your leadership evolved over time?
I mean, a lot of what drew me originally is in part where I grew up. So I grew up in California outside of the Bay Area. We all know I started this work 25 years ago, so we all know that I am of age to have grown up in the 80s.
I was like, do we get to the math? Yeah, how old were you when you started the work, right? Because like you were...
I was 21.
Yeah. A little baby, yeah, Kirsten, exactly. Out there in the world.
But growing up, I was kind of in the 80s. I was drawn to things that kind of look like very earlier traditional environmental issues. Like, I cared about dolphins. I grew up near the ocean, right? Like, I was a fourth grader who loved dolphins.
And, not manatees.
No.
I think the East Coast version of that was manatees. I grew up on manatees.
Yeah.
Thank you, Florida.
Beach cleanups are like recycling. And there was, the part of the origin story goes back to my dad, too. And both my mom was the one who gardened and who got me so in love with food and growing food and gardening. And my dad challenged me, both of them did, when I would say that there was something I saw in the world that I didn't think was right, which I think was a big part of who I was as a kid. Not like Shanna's not cutting in line, not that kind of right, yeah. But just like, I think I always just cared about people.
I am a line cutter. I appreciate you exposing me here today. I'm not actually. That's like my biggest nightmare. Go on.
Yes.
No, it really like creates anxiety in me to think about cutting in a line and being called out for it.
Yeah. No, I think also I might
also
have,
driven by sense of right and wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. And so, but mostly just not wanting to see anyone or anything hurt, I think is a big part of what you've started kind of my path to wanting, the world to be cared for and people to be cared for. And so we were at like my favorite cafe in downtown Santa Cruz, and they were using styrofoam, which I had learned was not good and that was going in the oceans and, the fish were eating it. And I wanted them to, I thought it was bad. And my dad was like, well, what are you going to do about it? And so I got my, this was in seventh.
I was like, how old are you?
Yeah. I was young. And so I was probably 11. I got my like middle school, all the kids and the teachers and the administrators. And we were a small school I wrote a letter and they all signed it that asked them to stop using it. And I called companies to find paper products because there was no internet and there was no like looking up on Amazon or
none of that
Mason.
Existed. Yeah.
And I said, you can do this and it's not that much more expensive to do paper. And so I sent it to them and I got a letter back and they said, thank you. And, we will make this change. And there was a small, it had like two or three shops in the area. And so I went the day they said they'd make the change and there was still styrofoam. And so I wrote another letter and they wrote back and said like, thank you. We're just using up our inventory, but we promise you it's being changed. And it was. And so that like sense of like, oh, if I feel a responsibility for if something should be different and I'd like it to change, then I also have to be a part of the change. And so that's like the very early version, but watching migrant farm workers and the way they were treated growing up in California, there was definitely like, it was a whole class of people who were being, exploited and discriminated against at that point, having, pesticides sprayed while they're picking. I just really cared, and thought about what, you can't separate, our food and the earth that's grown in and the people who grow it. And the people who eat it, like we're all connected to that concept of a food system. And so I was really fortunate to intern with a group that was one of the first in the nation for immigrant farming groups. We now have some of the standout ones here in Lewiston, Auburn, but it was the first of those in the nation. And I was able to intern with them, like with people who knew everything and I knew nothing, and really see them, with a group of people who were the most marginalized in our community. Forming their own businesses. They formed cooperative businesses and markets and had these like 3-year training programs to become independent organic farmers. And I was so inspired that, I did that in high school and again in college. And when I was in Lewiston, I just started to think about how could we use food to make change here.
So you know what I love about the first part of the story, the like cafe piece?
Yeah.
When you say, I see something that needs to be addressed and I feel like I have to do it, the way some people would see something and feel like they had to do it, be like, I'm not going to shop there anymore, or I'm just going to write a letter. You identified a problem, offered the solution and organized a letter writing campaign with your seventh grade class. And I would say those three ways, like, because a lot of people would deal with that in maybe a really individual way, or they'd maybe complain with somebody who works nearby or their partner or spouse. But like you organized your seventh grade class and gave solutions. And I think those are just points that I would pull out that I think really define your leadership, and what I've seen and appreciated about you and your approach with others is that you engage others in actively doing it. And I think that was the most succinct way I've ever had someone describe a food system too. Like, and I've been part of some charrettes with you where it's like 2 8x10 whiteboards artistic renderings. And I mean, it's a really, that was a very simple version, but because it is very complex, but
that's where we need to start. And I've learned that over the years. And you asked, there's nothing about me that gives short answers. You know that about me too.
That's why I was like, we're never going to get to all these questions. I'm just going to pick my favorites.
But you asked about kind of my growth or arc in leadership. Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of it is really trying to understand, you know, if I care about something, I am passionate about it, not trying to push my agenda or my opinion onto others in this community, or that's not how change is made. Right. And also that I rarely have the best idea or the best answer. I might have motivation, or I might have time or resources, but like what's going to create change and lasting change, and that where that really has not only like buy-in and understanding, but where people can feel the impact and want to be a part of it, is making it a joint effort. And so I think for me, going from the way we used to talk about and teach food systems was more complicated. But all the teens that came through our programs and were like, okay, and it's important to know those things to understand where you can make change, but you don't need to be an expert to start to have an understanding, and enough of an understanding to then give input that's going to bring a perspective or an idea that me and my seat and my lived experience is never going to be able to provide. So that's been a huge area of growth for me in my leadership. I think going from I don't think I was like, with a capital S, a self-righteous 20-year-old, but I was probably lowercase S. You see the world, and you're like, that's one of the things that is beautiful about youth and being young, and we've all been there. We actually really need that kind of calling out, and I've learned a lot about needing that and having it paired with calling in.
Yeah, just in like two sentences.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit more about calling in versus calling out, because I think, we're in a particular political environment where calling out has become just like more and more the approach that people use. And I appreciate calling in. I appreciate being called in.
Yeah.
I'm seldom the smartest person in the room too. And part of the way you learn is to be called into the learning.
Yeah.
But I think that the term, or even the difference between calling in or calling out, is still less normalized than like. So help me with that.
And I mean, I think you can dive into any kind of contentious issue, but just like make it a personal issue. Like if I am like interacting with my husband and I have like doing something that is either like causing hurt or just really annoying. Right?
Yeah.
The way that,
let me give you a concrete example.
Yeah.
Pushing the snooze button 5 times in the morning.
Yes, okay.
Exactly. You're welcome. That's my gift to Chad at home. I hope he feels seen. Guilty. Go on.
Yeah.
So, here's something concrete to work with.
So the calling out is like, it certainly is necessary at times. It is absolutely necessary to name when there's hurt or harm, or there's impact that someone might not be aware of. As humans, most of us, our defensiveness is triggered. Yeah. And you can't learn in a state of defensiveness. There's like lots of research around that, right? You can't learn when you're in a state of fear or defensiveness. You're actually in that moment not going to learn anything other than knowing if you can trust that person. That person has your interests in mind and has connection in mind. So for me, calling in is saying, is really speaking to like, hey, I understand you might not realize the impact of this, but here is what it is. It's probably not even your intention. I know you're not trying to deprive me of the 40 minutes of sleep from every snooze button,
but you are.
And I care about our relationship first and foremost. And so I'm coming from a place, that if I don't tell you these things, then I'm not creating a space for us to continue to strengthen strengthen our relationship. And it doesn't have to be a deep, intimate relationship for you to do that. It can be a neighbor. It can be someone who is on the opposite aisle of you when it comes to politics. But it's just saying, you know, listen, I see you as a human and a person first. Mm-hmm. I care about our relationship. I want to deepen connection. Mm-hmm. And also something you're doing is causing an impact that you might not be aware of. And I want you to be aware of it. And here's ways that I have changed. I used to do this thing. That's one of my favorite ways of calling in, is being really honest about all the ways that I have messed up in life and hurt people even without intention, but really caused a lot of hurt just because I didn't know or needed practice. And so I think a lot of that is for me the difference.
I love that. Well said. So I want to talk about, you've mentioned a little bit youth. I don't know if you've actually said the word, but I know we're going to get there anyway. Because we've talked about your work before in terms of justice. And I think a lot of people, I mean, not even if they look at your website, because it's pretty obvious, but depending on what facet they meet you, whether it's related to the farmers market, related to the food pantry work that the Nutrition Center does, I think sometimes your work gets simplified is maybe the word that I would use, to like food access.
Yeah.
Right? And I love it when you talk about your work in terms of food justice and youth empowerment. And that's where your work sits, kind of at the intersection of equity and opportunity and care. Tell me what core values have guided your leadership around these two pieces of youth empowerment and food justice. Not only you keep those values centered, but how you, I would go so far as to say, like, identify the shared values with youth and then center youth.
Yeah, that's not a layered question at all.
Sorry. In two sentences. Right. No, I'm just kidding. Take what you need on that one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think around kind of our work being simplified, on one level, it's necessary because we do not have a simple elevator speech.
No, you can't.
No, I mean, essentially we...
Same, by the way. That's the problem that we have here at the chamber.
Yeah, and I mean, in a lot of ways, it speaks to, our organizational values are shared and built from our team and with lots of input from those who are most impacted, including young people and people who are gardening and people who are getting food from our food pantry and our partners. But they started with just me saying, like, what are the core values, which were really built on my beliefs, and then they've evolved in a much better way because of all of that input. But, I think that one thing that has always been true is believing that good food is a right, that it's not a privilege, that every person needs access, not just to calories, but to good food.
Yeah, so not just food, but good food.
Yes. Yeah, and I mean, good food is...
Not like chocolate cake, which I think is good.
No, that's good. That's great. It's birthday parties. It's, but it's just the thing, food that is what you need and is home to you and is going to nourish your body and your soul and keep you connected to your family and your community. That those are all elements of good food. The beauty of that is it can be defined differently, and not put a judgment on something being bad food.
Right? I love that. Thanks. Yeah. I will have my cake and eat it too.
Yes, exactly.
Also a big fan of growing my own food.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have chocolate in my drawer at all times.
I know you do.
So I think that's one core value, but one of the benefits of it being simplified is that there's multiple entry points and access points, not just for people to come garden or for the schools to have amazing school gardens and nutrition programming in partnership with the schools and Food Corps. It's so that people can say, like, I identify with this part, or this is something that I can do or want to be involved in, and I don't have to fully understand a food system or food justice to get involved. And so that's one of the strengths of it. The challenge is that it's then on us to go from that entry point to building an understanding and ideally a commitment and action towards change around justice. And I'm going to give like a metaphor that moves from access to justice. Yeah. That's one of the things that I think can help understand. And then I'll talk more about those values.
Yeah.
We always hear people talking about, like, you know, give a man or a person a fish or teach them to fish, right?
Yeah.
And so if you think about that, like the message there is like, don't focus on charity, focus on building a skill, right? So you think about education and skill building, and that is key. But that's still putting that responsibility on the person. And the reason why that person doesn't have fish is not solely and usually only their responsibility.
Yeah.
And so then you think about what context are they fishing in. So you say, okay, So let's not just think about, you know, teaching a person to fish. Do they have a fishing rod? Okay, so they need to have resources, you know, access to resources to have the tools they need yeah. to use the skill that they're developing. Do they have a place to fish?
Yeah.
Are they allowed to fish there?
A wild.
Yeah. You know, is the water there safe and clean?
Mm.
Do they have transportation to that water? You know, if they fish more than what they need, who is, like, where is that fish going so it doesn't go to waste? Thinking about our waste and our yeah. you know, composting. So if you think about all of those things, you're thinking about, okay, of course there's an element of personal responsibility and action and skill building and education. It's also about opportunity. It is also about the systems and the infrastructure that we have as a community and what we value so that we can have those things in place for everybody. And so that's, for me, this shift from access to justice is really thinking about. And that's also, you start to think of it as a systems approach.
Yeah.
So that,
I don't know if you can think about justice and it not be about system.
Absolutely.
Even if the thing or the moment or the harm can somehow be identified by like one person or one
yeah.
moment,
yeah.
it's always propped up and surrounded by and perpetuated by these systems.
That's the water we swim yeah. in, right? And so that's why so many times harm that's caused, the person isn't trying to cause it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's because we're in it, but we don't know any different. And so when we're trying to create change, of course you start from those kind of hierarchy of needs and you say, let's make sure, like, yes, yeah, sometimes we just provide free fish.
Yeah.
And then let's make sure we can create time so someone can yeah. learn and then build from there. And so you know, but I think that one of the values that's guided my work and is absolutely kind of infused into the work of the Nutrition Center is that oftentimes we still think about that change coming from change makers or leaders or organizations.
Traditional, too. I'm using yeah. air quotes, like our listeners can see that.
Yeah.
But air quotes. Right. But traditional, right?
Yeah.
Like, 'cause I know that you and I think about leadership really similarly. Leadership yeah. can come from anywhere.
Yeah.
And but in that sentence, it is that typical, like, I'm yeah. waiting for the leader to make the change so
right.
that I can follow them or support them or
right.
just benefit from the change they
yeah.
have made.
Right. And, you know, and what that, you know, there's, for me, so many reasons why that doesn't work. And as someone who's, you know, is, you know, sitting in a position of leadership and power mm-hmm. in my role, there's so much I don't know. And I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to come up with the best solutions. But also, I am taking away the power from others if I'm the one who's making those changes
yeah.
Independently, or if our organization is. Yes, I can like, you bring resources and bring ideas and bring capacity, but you know, really, when we think about how we make that change, you know, that it has to come from the voices of those who are most impacted, and really the voices where in traditional settings it's harder to get access. Like a young person, even when we try, and we've made these mistakes ourselves, like, we're going to have an advisory board. I'm going to have one young person sit on that advisory board with adults and get their ideas. And we're like, and how we set that person
up. And that's going to be so awesome
right.
for that one young person.
And do those adults know how to work with mm-hmm. young people? Have we set them up to feel comfortable in that setting? You know, so you know, for me.
Did you set it in the middle of the school day so
right.
that one young person is getting in trouble every
right.
time they attend?
Exactly. Or have to disrupt their,
yeah.
their. So, you know, those are all things that, you know, I think about. But that, you know, for me, one of those core values has always been to center the people who are most impacted. And to really listen to them and what their needs are, and to really share power.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I'm positionally or by my identity in a position of power or privilege, you know, my commitment to share that power and really make sure we're creating very real avenues for other people mm-hmm. to hold their own power. And that moves from, you know, ideas into action.
So there's that resonates so much, and it actually gave me a flashback, like full reflection flashback moment. But what I think is something you can fully appreciate, and that might be something that is different in our own personal lived experiences,
yeah.
is at one point in my life, I was the person directly impacted of whom others centered in leadership to get thinking, to get insights. And it was during that point in my life that I learned a lot about leadership. I see others of whom, so like part of your whole ethos in your work is centering leaders. Part of leadership development for those of us who are investing in creating space, supporting the growth of other leaders, is helping with the inflection point mm-hmm. of someone who's been directly impacted, who has found their space in leadership, maybe their desire yeah. to lead through being directly impacted, through identifying as having been marginalized and being called into this leadership role, and then growing
yeah.
not just their skills and their leadership, but maybe even their privilege to a place where they have to then pivot and support those same roles for others. Yeah. And it, I remember that like inflection moment for me. And I know that that's been a really powerful and sometimes challenging thing to support others in their leadership yeah. and moving from that space to this,
yeah.
this other space of being like, okay, now I'm growing my own leadership, but now I'm focused really on yeah. centering others.
Yeah, and I mean, and we, I do know that we have different experiences yeah. from, you know, growing up, and so I can't, you know, I can only speak for my own, but I know that so many times that, you know, there's like unspoken norms and cultures mm-hmm. around in settings and in institutions and in systems and organizations that really inhibit that inflection point and can
yeah.
keep people who have the desire, who are yeah. already engaging in all that leadership, but kind of keep that pivot from happening. And that requires really deep work,
yeah.
Both personally and organizationally, to say, okay, what within our systems, when it comes to our hiring processes, when it comes to mm-hmm. like our community norms. And so you had asked about, you know, our values or my values, and I'd said a lot of those are reflected. You know, we have like core values that, and one of those is young people are partners in change.
Yeah.
And then we have
maybe one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Of yours.
Yeah. And also loose nominators is yeah. our home is yeah. another one.
Yeah.
You know, we love this place. That's literally the core value. When thinking about opportunities for young people, you know, a lot of times the opportunities we create are both like programmatic, like come be a summer youth gardener mm-hmm. and get your first experience in a job setting, in community setting, like, you know, both engaging in your community, learning how to cook. Yes, you do actually touch soil and worms and learn how to garden some too, like all of those elements, but it's really about, you know, building. You know, a lot of times young people, they go into their first job and they've never had they have no idea what's expected of them or how to be,
yeah.
how, like, what's, you know, what they should do in a workplace setting. And so, and saying, it's, you know what, you're not going to lose this opportunity
yeah.
if you're late three times. We're going to work with you. We're going to identify what's happening and
yeah.
help you figure out how to move forward and how you're going to do this on your own moving forward. But I think it's recognizing the investment is a complicated word because it seems one-sided, but it's a community investment or
yeah.
a joint investment in saying, how do we recognize that the real barriers that, you know, particularly folks who do not have access to a lot of resources and are marginalized, to be able to have opportunity, but the support along with
yeah.
it, to be able to then continue to grow. And that's, you know, one of the things that I love about our work. Mm-hmm. It also means sometimes it can get a little bit messy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, it's not as clean as some other elements of our work, but, you know, there are so many young people who have started through one of our entry programs and gone, you know, kind of through leadership ladders mm-hmm. with us. And not only have become, you know, critical to our work as staff members
yeah.
or fellows or board members, but
yeah.
like also have, you know, taken on leadership positions across this community, and that's them, not us, but they need opportunities and you know, and ones where it's okay to make some mistakes and
yeah.
learn and grow, and we're supporting that growth and the growth mindset rather than saying, yeah, you've hit these couple of walls and then there's no further opportunity for you.
I know that there's so much difference between your work and the work that the chamber does. And I love those differences because there's lots of opportunities to serve different things, different
mm-hmm.
people. When a chamber member or a business person asks me about our Uplift LA and why
yeah.
the chamber does Uplift LA, you know, I speak in business terms. And so to our business leaders out there, you know, the investment that we make in our rising professionals, which is
yeah.
like, you know, workforce youth, you know, 18 to 40, we make investments in them because it helps attract and retain the talent that our members need. So like
yeah.
that's the chamber answer. But the, you know, the
and
more casual
necessary.
it's yeah.
yeah,
but the more casual answer to that is like for your people to grow inside your company, you need to give them opportunities that as a business owner, you might be risk adverse to saying, sure, take over the social media account, or right. sure, here's the budget, go ahead and run that program and see how it goes. And that's what we do with yeah. our, because there has to be spaces and support and tolerance for failure and risk and an acknowledgement that failure is learning. And so it looks so different the way that we do that. But yeah. I think that's our core beliefs around what Uplift LA is and does, because yeah. people need space to do that.
I agree. And I mean, I made so many mistakes early in my career, and I make them every day, right?
Same.
You know, and but the more you kind of build people's trust in you, then the mm-hmm. more room you have to make mistakes, recover, learn, and improve. You know, and I think so many people are cut off from being able to even start that arc, which is where the challenge lies. And it does take some risk tolerance. It does take some additional resources up front,
yep.
you know, and clear boundaries and barriers, you know, like boundaries to just say, like, this is what we can do and what we can't do. But, you know, I think that in particular, you know, a lot of times people gave me the benefit of the doubt because of like my education background. And I was like, just because I have a college degree does not actually mean that I'm good at meeting deadlines, that I'm good at communicating, or that I, you know, there's like, you know, there's a lot
so
of
much
things,
truth
right?
in that.
You know, so I think that, that we give certain preference to either education backgrounds or other identifiers for folks in the workforce, but saying, oh, actually, you know, what we need is all these other kinds of skill sets too, and some of those skills are actually the easiest to support people in developing. But you know, not figuring out how to problem solve, like you know, a 14-year-old who's figuring out how to get to a job on their own and doing it. If they're late a couple of times, but they're figuring out how to do that consistently, they are showing a lot of skill sets and resilience that someone else who can just drive there and be on time is not, right? So
I was laughing, not about the deadline piece so much as the like assumption that college kids have it all figured out.
Yeah.
Do you know what I look for in a resume? That is like one of my like, aha, this person, I want to talk to this person. If they've ever been in the service industry, particularly bartending or waiting tables, that is going to be the utmost customer service there. And these are things like I have not yet found anyone who did not have real lived work experience and had great college records who had these skill sets.
Yeah.
You build these skill sets outside of a college setting. And so there are so many things that I find really important to like our team and the work that we do that I would never see on someone's college transcript.
Right.
It wouldn't be enough to convey that to me. And so excuse my deep chuckle when you said that, but I am always looking for the bartenders and servers, and I don't care if it's 20 years ago in their timeline.
But you knew how to handle stress and how to hustle.
Yeah. You know, it's like, it's that. And you know that even if that person is being absolutely awful, you're going to know how to manage that person, whether it's removing them from the table and bar or making them happy enough to get out and get the best tip that you can out of it. You're going to figure that out. And there's some folks who just don't have that skill set.
It takes practice. Takes practice. Thinking on your feet.
So do you have some background in the service industry?
Not enough for your resume threshold, maybe. But,
you could throw it on there. We could wordsmith what you could put on your resume. But it does. It makes such a difference. I mean, it's no different than what you're doing.
What I say is that I, you know, it's somewhat parallel, but for our work, if you've worked on a farm.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter what role you're going into now, but if you worked on a farm, then there's just pieces, you know, you have to problem solve every day. And you have to be able to work hard and deal with all sorts of people and animals and conditions, you know, but.
And weird stuff.
Right. Yeah. Or just like, or someone who's like, well, I have worked on farms where, you know, you're like, where is the hammer? Right. And you spend 20 minutes looking for the hammer, you know? And so like, you just there's things you learn of like, oh, well that's, I'm going to value like having something where I know what it is. Cause that makes my day more efficient and it makes my team member happy because they know where it is too. Those kinds of things.
That's a really good one. I have not worked on a farm, so I probably would make it in my resume.
No, not everybody has either. It's not a requirement. It's just something else, you know, helps you see, you have insight, right?
What gives you hope right now about the future of food systems, equity, or community leadership in Maine?
Yeah.
Let's find hope.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of challenges, and, you know, I can speak to some of those too, but there's a couple of things that give me hope, maybe even three that I would name right now.
I love that.
But
we'll take as many as you can give us. There's no limit to hope.
And that is with the big, you know, star asterisk, knowing that this is actually very, very hard time for this work, you know, both on that, you know, the cuts to emergency food that we're seeing real impacts to the food coming into our food pantry, as well as cuts to, you know, USDA cuts to both our, you know, our key partners and farming, you know, immigrant farming and other projects in this community. The things that give me hope is, one, you mentioned like a movement, like where we are now is not where we were 20 years ago in this community or nationally. And the food systems and food justice movement is a lot stronger and more, it has many different components and elements and leaders. Like when I first started, people were like, why are you putting gardens in downtown or at Hillview? Like there was just this like not even understanding that that could have any lasting impact or that they would be valued by community members, but if it's folks doing the work, then they value it, right? Part of it is just like like now people are like, oh, that's a no-brainer. We want gardens in our community. We want gardens in our schools, and we want to be able to have a strong farmers market, which was, you know, is over 20 years old now from when we started it. But so part of it is just that the growth, evolution, and kind of the bench that exists both nationally in Maine and in this community when it comes to food systems and food justice work. I think the faces of leadership have changed a lot too in a really important way. So that gives me hope, just that there's ton of really passionate, brilliant people doing this work
here in Maine too.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so much so that like it has attracted additional people, younger people, diverse people,
absolutely,
to our state because they see and want to be part of that movement.
And part of that being a movement versus just a sector is that when we're talking about our food system, we're also talking about our local economy, which is, you know, the Chamber's partnership with Local Foods Action Plan and your leadership there, you know, that we all see that these things are connected and it's not this silo of like, oh, it's nice to have a garden or a farmer's market. They are like, these pieces are essential for us to have a thriving and climate resilient community. So that's one piece. And, you know, two, which seems like really, you know, generic, but is, since we've been talking about young people so much, you know, it's coming from a place of real, of like deep truth for me, is that, you know, I really have so much, you know, confidence and trust in the wisdom and strength of young people and in this community in particular. We are like the youngest community in Maine, which is such a strength. I, every day that we have young people involved in our work, am both really blown away by how the things that they understand that I had no concept of until I was like 30.
Wild.
You know, they're just like, they're holding both because there's a lot of more urgent and pressing challenges, but you know, they're holding a lot of weight of where we are, which can be very hard, but they're also holding a deeper understanding and a real, you know, again, when we talked very early about both of us being like, you know, growing up with the sense of wanting to do what is right and good for people, that I see that in so many of the young people we're working with. And so, you know, really, really strong leadership from a lot of people who are much younger and who I'm learning a lot from. And so I think that, you know, a lot of people talk about mentorship, and I just really like the concept of like co-mentorship and reverse mentorship. Like, same. I have a lot to learn, especially on social media, but like on all sorts of other things. I have a lot to learn. And, you know, in not just, you know, I know we're in the nonprofit sector, but you're thinking across businesses, you know, within this community, and we were talking about creating those pathways and those opportunities, but like actually we will not be relevant if we aren't doing the work with young people helping lead our work. So I think that gives me hope. The last piece is just how much, you know, Lewiston Auburn is a special place. It has been, and how many people love this community yeah. and care for it. And that shows up in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think that often like I and others will use the word gritty when we talk about mm-hmm. this community. There is just a toughness here.
Yeah.
But the toughness comes from also a place of like deep commitment and care for this yeah. community. And that gives me hope as well.
I used to just think of it as grit, right? Yeah. We are that way because of a resilience we've built.
Yeah.
Either through the life that we've lived here or our life on behalf of mm-hmm. this community and our work in the community. And I used to think of like underdog and kind of like grittiness, you know, in other places or in the way others thought about us. And I never really linked it to this notion of like, grittiness is the ability to like walk 3 miles with a pebble in your shoe, right? Like you're just gonna work through it.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a great resilience and of which we as a community and as a shared people yeah. had long before October 25th. I mean, I think right. we use that word a lot more
yes.
post October 25th. But yeah, I mean, this community was resilient as it built the mills. It was resilient as it shut down the mills and yeah. figured out a new history. It was resilient coming out of kind of the social club takeover of downtown, which like yeah. just barely predates my, you yeah. know, coming to town. And yeah. so I love that. I mean, I love gritty. I think I prefer the yeah. word gritty because I yeah. think it's a little more, you can paint a mental picture.
Right.
Resilience sounds like it's maybe a little shiny on the edges, maybe a right. little softer, and like, I like that we're a little tougher.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, I think that it's both individuals here, but it's just this kind of collective
yeah.
Approach and identity. You know, I think everyone would also like it to be a little easier.
Yeah.
you know.
Man, that part, yeah. right? Like, without yeah. losing it, I just, right. without, not like losing it, losing my mind, but like, without losing that sense of like, commitment yeah. and ability to overcome and to, yeah. you know, to take what may come your way and find a way through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be nice if it was a little yeah. bit easier.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
But I think it's just, you know, that it's a lot of it is also the strength of the connections. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was thinking about two other things that are tied to that hope. But, like, you know, one is we have a network of school gardens that didn't exist, you know, 15 years ago
yeah.
in the elementary schools. And, like, you know, so many kids are getting exposed to gardens, outdoor learning, experiential learning, and healthy foods through that work. And you just think about, you know, generational impact when that's a norm. And that's what I love to think about with the gardens in particular. And then also with the farmer's market, but it's to think about things that just like, you know, kid growing up now, it's like, of course there's a garden in yeah. my neighborhood. Of course I can do this at school. Mm-hmm. And same with the farmer's market. You know, there's like one of the things I love that we've heard from vendors. And again, this is, you know, Sherry Blumenthal's leadership and a lot of others doing
She's
the
incredible.
Work. The farmers and vendors in this market, one of the things they say they love is that they're feeding their community.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they can often make more money at a coastal market, you know, and during the summer, but they're like, this is my community and I'm feeding my community. And that's where I think that grittiness comes back to mm-hmm. me thinking about just like that it's a weaving that's happening at the same
yeah.
time. It's just not individuals mm-hmm. that have that grittiness and resilience, but also as a community.
Yeah.
We are in a time that's incredibly divisive, and you know, this kind of through line that you and I are talking about mm-hmm. this. So when you fall down, like getting up totally on your own so many yeah. times gets harder and harder. But yeah. if you fall down and you're in community and you have connections, like then it's like, well, you fell down and I'm here this time.
Yeah.
And then now I fell down and you're here this time.
Yeah.
It's not that, yes, we do have those cycles as a community, but I do think that that's for me, the ability to get back up is a skill.
Yeah.
It's a practice.
Yeah.
And it's one that like when you're like, I can't do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But someone, you know, said something a little while ago that really helped me, which is like I can't do this, and just say like I can't do this alone.
Yeah.
You just add that one word, then it's like, okay, then how are we doing this together? Yeah.
Oh, that's such helpful framing.
Yeah.
There's a metaphor about choirs that a choir can hold the same note for 15 minutes for longer. Mm. And it's in a way that one person never could. And it's because there are enough people that somebody can pause and take the breath and you don't hear it. Mm-hmm. The note continues on and everybody is able to breathe at the time they need to because there are others who are able to carry that note. And that's what I think of and what the difference is in being in community.
Yeah.
Before I move on, I'm seeing scribble notes, and do you have anything that you want to ask or add?
Sure.
And not save it till the end? Do it.
Wow, you're just breaking all the rules. It's crazy.
I know. Let's switch it up. We'll sing next. I'll come up with some other really obscure old song that we're terrible at. We'll pepper it in, Mark. That'll be our new thing. It's going to be awesome.
I love it.
Look for one next time.
I'm 100% in. Kirsten, I'm curious, if you had the attention of the parents of Lewiston Auburn and you could deliver a message on food and nutrition, let's say you had their attention for a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
What would you tell them?
Oh, gosh, that's a really good and hard question. Because a couple minutes. That's just a personally hard question.
No PowerPoint, no 30 minutes. Right, exactly. You're at the garden and they're captive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that first and foremost, you know, forming a healthy relationship with food is so important, and it's not easy to do, but it's also not as hard as it can be. You know, I think, you know, being able to say, okay, how do you build a connection to food and ways to do that? So, and it might not be something you can do at home, but how do you have access to it? Because what we see is, you know, a kid who grows spinach in a garden is way more likely to eat it than if they don't. Or if they grow it and cook it, even more likely. And, you know, so they, and I'm not just saying like every kid needs to grow and eat spinach, right? It's just thinking about how do you have a connection? And so supporting kids and saying like, I'm going to like understand and think about my food. So like if it's coming onto the table, you know, it's not just something that I just without any like an awareness I'm consuming, but that I'm, you know, paying a little bit of attention. And that, you know, a tiny practice of being connected, I think can help you know, parents and kids start a healthier relationship to food. And so it could be just like curiosity, just saying like, okay, let's like, I wonder who grew this, or I wonder where it came from, you know, or I wonder what it would taste like if I did this. But I think a lot of times, you know, and I'm a parent, like we put pressure on our kids to both like eat, you know, whatever we define as good or healthy, which is of course, you know, different across every household, or we're worried about our babies that aren't eating enough, or, you know, whatever it is. But we have this very fraught relationship like with food, in part because sometimes it's scarce. Sometimes it can make people sick. Sometimes, you know, there's so much that's hard about food. So I think just starting with like forming a relationship and understanding that it becomes a part of you. It's moving into your body and building who you are. And so forming that relationship. And then along with curiosity is just trying things. So I will make it a little bit personal. My kiddo who's 5, when he was really little and we wanted to just continue to encourage trying things you don't like, is that like I had read a long time ago, like research that said on average it takes an adult trying something 11 times to learn to at least tolerate it. You might not love Brussels sprouts, but then you're like, okay, 11 times is a lot to try something you don't like, right? And so, but my kid changed it to 19.
Great job, Mom.
It's also about like trying other things that are scary.
Yeah.
You know, but like it's just, you know, saying, okay, let's just try something. And sometimes as parents, and also like with, you know, food is so expensive, and even before these huge increases in food, it is really challenging for a lot of people, is really taking advantage of programs at the schools where they can learn and experiment and come home and say like, oh, it turns out I do like broccoli, you know, and here's the recipe I got from my after school cooking club.
And as you talked, it's not just it is the relationship with food. It took me a long time to realize that I had an unhealthy relationship
with food.
Like just really, and to think about it, just fundamentally different. And that was in my like breaking generational cycles. That was part of my focus with my kids. And I put a lot of what a safe and healthy household looks like to me. I would say the type of food and quantity of food in the house is like 80% of how I define that. whether that's right or not and what you might infer, but it's true. Like, it's just fundamentally an empty fridge. Even if it's, I just came home from a week vacation and of course it's empty and of course I have the means to fill it, is a panic attack for me in terms of like failing as a parent. And so I spent a lot of time being thoughtful about the relationship with food that my children have. Yeah. And that made my relationship with them better. Not just their relationship with food, but whether it was preparing a meal together or picking the recipe together or going to the grocery store together or planting the garden together. And it's still like part of my favorite moments with my all adult children now, like, are around food. And it's not just like, you know, birthday cake candles or celebratory moments. It's like some of them are the failures that we make in our like experimental destiny. Just killed it, not in a good way, with eggplant not too long ago, and was like, Mom, we never ate eggplant. And I'm like, no, son, we did not. And now you have a better understanding of why. It's hard to make. Right. And for it to be good, it's even more challenging to do that well. Shout out to Destin, who fearlessly tries new recipes every week.
But yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's not just the relationship with food that you articulated so well that I found important, but it had this whole extra benefit. And I don't know if parents would help to hear that, but like I love grocery shopping with my kids, and that was not something I could say the entire time they were growing up. Like, that took a place of evolution for our relationship, but it's one of my favorite things.
No, I do too. And I'll just be like, okay, we're, you know, in the produce section, pick out one thing you want to try, you know, just because then there's like, that, especially for younger kids, a sense of like ownership and agency, and then they get to pick it out, you know, and so that can also really help. But no, I agree 100%.
I love that part. I love that part.
Yeah.
Do you have another one?
Earlier, you said that we have a right to good and nutritious food. How do we exercise that right?
Ooh.
That's a great question.
That's a really good question.
That's a really good question. So, I mean, I think that so much of it, you know, comes down, you know, it is on all the layers from, you know, like we talked about with the fish, right? So from like the kind of personal decisions all the way up to, you know, to national policy. I think a lot about, for people who have never experienced food insecurity in any real way, when the pandemic hit and all of a sudden the grocery stores had empty shelves everywhere and people were like, what am I going to eat? Are we going to have food? Will we, you know, that fear of like, will I have food for my family or for myself? Will I have that? That fear is a fear that millions of people in this country feel every day. And how that impacts your ability to do anything else.
Yeah,
is
fundamentally.
Huge, right? So when we think about the economic impacts, the learning impacts for kids, that, you know, so to exercise it has to say, like, as a collective, as a society, we have to agree that no person should be hungry. It doesn't mean that we think that everybody should, you know, have
steak access. And lobster.
Yes.
Sorry. Just use a tangible experience from the real world. Right. Go on.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean that that it has to be luxurious, but that everybody should have their basic food needs met. And the more they can have autonomy and control over that, the better. I mean, we are a big part of the emergency food system. We're one of the largest food pantries in the state, a part of a great network through Good Shepherd. We gave out over 650,000 pounds of food last year. That is not what that can meet the needs in our community. There's much more, and it's growing rapidly right now with, you know, costs of food and other policy changes. During the pandemic, there were some policy shifts, and you know, that included child tax credits and also included increase in SNAP benefits. We saw the sharpest dive in childhood poverty that we've seen in decades, you know, because of that. And then as soon as those benefits ended, it went right back up. So in Maine and across the country. And so we need a collective will to say this, you know, meeting especially children's food needs is the smartest thing we can be doing for our community and our country, in my mind. You know, that is, if we do that, if kids don't have to worry about getting their food needs met and can study and learn at school and play and build relationships, you know how to navigate the world, then they're going to be in a much better spot. And so, you know, it does, and I think for me, this is not politics. This is just saying, like, what is our responsibility as a community? Yeah. To do that, and so it's both, you know, access and the means to be able to do it, but ideally not having to hop to four different places, across two jobs and no transportation, to get your food needs met, but instead, you know, having those basic needs met and then being able to go from there.
you talk about autonomy. A lot of people maybe make assumptions or are pulling from real lived experience about a lot of emergency food system supports and what that looks like. And it does tend in so many places to be like, you show up and somebody gives you a box and that box has what was available. Thank you to the local grocery store. Thank you to Good Shepherd. Thank you to maybe some farms and what's in season. But more often than not, it's like, here's the stuff that we could get the most quantity of, not quality, not right. Not weight. Because like the last thing someone who's unhoused and living out of a backpack needs is 40 pounds of canned goods and no oven to cook most of them with. So anyway, people who come to your food pantry have autonomy in that experience in a way that is like, you guys kind of broke the ground on that. And a lot of people might not know. And so can you briefly describe what that experience
is
like?
I get it. I get the message.
I've got one more question I want to get in.
Absolutely. And yes, while we are one of those, there's many others that are doing similar versions. And, but it is really a shift. And again, it's recognizing it's autonomy and it's dignity. And because nobody wants to go to.
They feel like they're not the same thing, but like they come closely related,
Right. You know, it's just like, nobody wants to go to a food pantry. No one wants to ask for help, right? Like, I mean, it is, there's so many emotions and shame tied to, you know, being able to access particularly, you know, emergency food, because that's your most basic need. And so we essentially said, okay, how do we create a model that is centering the person and their experience and their ability to make choices and have a dignified and caring and respectful experience when they're here. And so it looks like a free food store. So you know, the way that people come in, we try to do everything we can to limit the lines. I mean, we on an average Tuesday see 350 households or more. So it, you know, it is packed and busy. But essentially, you
it's shopping.
Yeah, it's shopping. You get a grocery cart, like a hand cart, just like you would when you walk into you know, any local grocery store, and you pick out the foods. There's some guidance around, you know, taking so many of something when we have limited amounts, but you get to say like, yeah, my kids don't like
broccoli. You're welcome. It's me. My kids like broccoli. It's me.
Yeah, or just like you prefer spaghetti over noodles, and they happen to have over elbows and have spaghetti today, and so you can pick that. But it's also you taking it off the shelf yourself versus a volunteer who is there to help but is not handing it to you. Again, just like the actual visceral experience of, I'm doing this for myself. And while I would rather be doing this in a more conventional setting, like a grocery store with, you know, my dollars or my SNAP, I can't, and I'm here. And then you go and pack up your bags and leave the cart and go out. And so having that choice means we reduce food waste. People get the food that they want to need. They don't take more than they need, you know, because they're like, okay. The other part of that is constant messaging. And this has been a lot. Our leader, our team, our food pantry team, you know, across the team speaks like 8 different languages, really understands our community really well. And is saying, how do we, in a really hard situation, bring out the best in everybody? Because their nervous systems, everyone, it is a hard place to be. And so everything in there is designed to support people and being able to, you know, really feel good about getting their needs met, but also recognizing that there's others in the line that are also going to need to have their needs met, and that they don't, instead of thinking of it from a scarcity mindset, there's like a stability mindset. I can't get everything I need from this visit, but I'm going to get a core amount, and then I can trust that there will be things here next week.
See, I love that. People who aren't in that position, and hopefully never have to be, wouldn't know what that experience is like.
Right.
And the effort that you guys and your team put into, like, having a dignified experience.
All I have to say, think is, like, if I... what would I do for my kid?
Yeah.
I'd do almost anything to make sure my kid
got food. Totally.
If I didn't have food on the table.
100%.
So you just have to say like, okay, that's the place that everyone is who's experienced any trauma around food is going to be, even if they don't mentally acknowledge it, is in their bodies.
We've talked a lot about change.
Yeah.
The change that you've seen in all these years, the change that you're making, the movement that is about change. We love talking about how people navigate change. I think the world is perpetually in change. And so that's something we always kind of hearken back to, not just around the change that's happening around them, but within the organization that they help shape. So I know that the Nutrition Center is stepping into a new chapter soon.
Yeah.
I think maybe with a new name, a new look, a refreshed sense of direction. We're not going to give it all away here today, guys. You're going to have to hold on a little bit. But as I know all too well and have watched you also literally labor with love, that kind of shift doesn't happen overnight, and it often reflects something deeper. Share a little bit about what has inspired your evolution and whatever else you're able to share at this precursor of time. You're this exciting moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we have to do what some other like podcast do, but this is re-recording on this date. Who knows what will happen by the time it's released.
It's such a good point. Check back for live updates.
Right, exactly. Or timestamp. The news has changed in the last 5 minutes since we reported this. No, thanks for the question and the opportunity to share.
Yeah,
and I mean, I will say, and this is not to like put you on the spot, but that my approach to change has been improved significantly by working alongside you over the years.
Thanks.
I mean, I just think, you know, the way that you embrace and instigate change is.
I think that nails it. I don't know anybody else appreciates that the way you just described it.
It's what's needed, you know. So I think that my personality can be a little more cautious and a little too planful at times, which you know from some of our work decades ago together, but
has also taught me a lot over the years.
Yeah, so there's and I own that as a strength too, right? Yeah. That's like a real strength.
100%.
But also being able to really be excited about change. And I say that knowing that actually I have been a change maker, you know, my whole life.
Yeah, you have.
But,
that's right.
But it's been at a certain pace. And so, you know, this work also reflects that pace. So, yeah, but I think that for me, what I have recognized is that, you know, I would much rather me personally, our organization or our community, be setting the direction for change than be reacting to change.
Yes.
Right. And so that's how I think, you know, to your question broadly, just about thinking about leadership and change, is that coupled with removing the expectation that anything is ever going to be static or easy.
Yeah.
Right? Like, just like you being like, why is it changing? Why is it changing? Like all of the energy that goes into either trying to keep something the same or to be surprised by all of the uncertainty in an uncertain world is that I think I've always felt I had a strength in adapting and responding, but also saying, how are we preparing, and how are we, to the best of our abilities, setting up, the conditions for the change we want to see?
Yeah.
In our community, in our organization, and personally, maybe personally is the worst one, but you know, we all have our challenges.
We're whole people.
Yes,
we are. Just as a reminder, we say that a lot, but like, we're whole people.
Yes, exactly. So I can walk the walk more in some areas than others. So now I feel like I have an excitement around change that has grown over the years in a way where I can say, okay, you know, this is, you know, there's so much opportunity for building the kind of world we want, and that involves change.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, the kind of short version of what's instigated change for us and where we're going is coming from that. We've been in a, you know, this amazingly fortunate place of having a strong, you know, relationship and being part of St. Mary's for 25 of our 26 years.
They've been incredible.
I was 21 and had an idea about a garden and, you know, and did that for a year with some great support, including from, you know, Peggy Rotundo when I was still at Bates and, you know, out at Hillview and the cooperative extensions and very early partners who just said, this seems like an idea worth supporting. And then for the very next year, having support from St. Mary's to expand it and eventually build a home base and become a part of the health system. And, you know, to have a health system that both believed in young leadership and trusted young leadership. And
yours, and not just your programming, but you were a young leader.
I was a young leader. Right. I mean, I had no professional experience outside of those summer jobs and and, you know, jobs while I was in school. I'd never worked in a full-time job. So having that, the trust in that, and that was, you know, leadership, you know, at the time. And I learned a lot from the leadership there as well. Jim Casti, who's still involved as a volunteer of our work. And, you know, so to go from a place of being able to start the work and with an organization that has been here for over 135 years and knows this community and has done a lot to invest and has seen that their role is not just as a health system, but as a big employer in this community, but also invested in B Street and housing in downtown in early 2000s when there had been no housing investment, really had a lot of foresight to say, how are they helping live their mission, which was to really commit to this community and particularly those who are most marginalized. And so there was so much that aligned with us being a part of St. Mary's for so long. And, you know, we're at a point where it's not that it doesn't align, but where they are a health system and we are a community change organization. Yeah. And just recognizing that as the world continues to evolve and change, our ability to respond to that change will be in a better spot to do that as a standalone nonprofit. So that's where we're headed. That's why we will have a new name and a new look. St. Mary's has been
incredible.
And will continue to be, supporting us in the transition. So there's, immense, care for this, for everyone experiencing a really stable change. So that essentially we'll have a new name and we'll look, but the gardens will be there, the schools programs will be there, the youth programs, our community meals, the people, those things are not changing. But it positions us to be able to respond to changing times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Fast forward to our future selves. It's May 14th when this is released.
Yeah.
What is the best way for people, because some of this still won't be public then,
right?
Which is why we're not saying names.
Right,
we're talking about your flashy new look.
Yeah.
It's flashy.
Well, flashy feels like it's earthy.
It is. I feel like that's flashy from where you come from, though.
Yes,
it's like a whole new color palette.
It's very intentional and had tons of input.
Yeah.
And our name actually came from like a final session with young people, which feels like living our values.
Yeah. So where could somebody listening today, if you're listening on a release date, thanks for subscribing. If you aren't, subscribe right now.
Yes.
but somebody listening today, where could they learn more about you and keep up with the announcements about your changes?
Yeah, so our current website, which is stmarysnutritioncenter.org, and that's ST for St. Mary's, will be forwarding to our new website.
So they can just go check you out.
So they can go right there and then they'll find it. Same with our Facebook page that the St. Mary's Nutrition Center will also just have a name change.
It'll just surprise.
Yeah, all of a sudden it'll look different.
I'll tell you, because I've done this with a couple organizations, your notifications will say St. Mary's Nutrition Center changed their name.
Exactly.
And then you'll get so go like them right now so that you can get the early notification that something is afoot.
Exactly. And we've made a clear commitment as a staff not to share our name, but I decided we would give a teaser, which is our acronym, so that people can guess for the few days or week before it goes live, but that is GTG.
Oh.
So you can, it's kind of like, I don't know what those radio show games where you have to call in, but because I have this big microphone in front of me, I feel inspired.
You can give them our phone number.
Right,
we'll send them your way.
Yeah, exactly. But you can, you can post it on our Facebook page if you have
excited. If you guys haven't already picked up on this, like, you will want to follow the work, because not only is the work that Kirsten and her team have been doing incredible, and they are positioned to continue to invest and deepen that work, but to grow that work at a time when the landscape is changing around you, and there is a need for you to, that there's always need, but there's a need for you to continue to build your movement, not just deliver the programs, which are vital and wonderful. But your kind of scaffolding that really supports all of your work is a movement that you've been building and that is picking up steam. And so, join it.
Yeah.
Go like them on their Facebook page so that you stay up to speed and be on the lookout for all the cool things to come, because I don't have to know where you're headed to know that it's going to be incredible and our communities will be better because of it. Our people will be better because of it. Our economies will be better because of it. And so... I'm super excited. Yeah. Can't wait for announcement day.
No, I mean, me too. And also, got a lot to do.
There are some checklists.
One thing, just wrapping up kind of full circle to our relationship and kind of and this podcast at this moment is, another thing I'd really encourage people to check out is the Local Foods Action Plan website. The Chamber's a big, lead in that work with our many lead partners. But that's where, when we think about a movement, what's reflected in that, which, it sounds like a website, but it's a living plan with commitments across, you know, municipalities, organizations, individuals, schools.
And for a lot of us, we're in businesses. Year four of those commitments, recommitting to another multiple year stretch because we believe in the work.
Yeah. And so instead of a plan that's on a shelf, it is a living plan that we are all making happen together. And that's what feels different than 25 years ago, even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And is, you know, and why we do that kind of convening and work is that it is, and it is not just within the nonprofit sector.
Yeah.
It is across all of the sectors within our community that are making it happen. And that's, you know, when we think about change, like setting a vision and moving towards it together is one thing I'm excited about. So
join us for Taste the Harvest, because that's what that looks like in real time.
Yeah.
That's part of how we live into the work that we're doing. So if you've participated in the eLocal Challenge the last couple of years, or have seen things going on Lisbon Street in October, or have come to the Taste the Harvest, that's, you know, that's the most visible part of the work that we do together as it relates to the local food plan. Parting words. Ready?
Yes.
The short version.
Okay.
What is something that you, I'm gonna reframe this. What is something that you would put on a bumper sticker that you would tell somebody, or would be words to inspire somebody getting involved in systems work?
And a bumper sticker.
Those are my guardrails, the bumper sticker.
Yeah. You're making it hard. I'm going to spend more time thinking about it than I would just saying.
Yeah, but he'll edit that out.
I mean, if you can really decrease the font on a bumper sticker.
Oh, yeah. I do that.
That's
right. Yeah.
That's a good point.
No, sometimes you have to get really close to be able to read those bumper stickers.
And then it tells you if you can read this.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I would say...
it could be bigger than a bumper sticker.
No, I know. It's maybe like it's a couple of bumper stickers.
That's fine. I'll take them.
One,
I'll buy the whole series and put them on my car.
One is that it takes time.
Mm.
And you can't always see the progress.
Mm.
But it doesn't mean that it's not, things aren't happening. So I think that's a big part of systems change. And then the other is you find people who are very different than you and work alongside them to make change.
I love that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no,
I
thank you.
I appreciate it.
As I said, I was nervous about this because I am an introvert, but you made it very easy.